The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jory Slotkey from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the March 2019 issue of Discover Magazine. We begin with the cover story, A Lost World Emerges. From massive fortresses to sprawling suburbs, a bold new vision of the Maya takes shape. Thomas Garrison pauses in the middle of the jungle. That's the causeway right there, he says, pointing to a random patch of greenery in the Guatemalan lowlands. I squint, trying to make out features in the tangled rainforest undergrowth. There's a small lump, rising no more than a foot or two from the forest floor. The Ithaca College archaeologist has spotted the buried remnants of a Maya road, a ribbon of limestone that once cut through the wrinkled landscape. We're a full day's walk from civilization, standing in the remains of a once populous kingdom. The road before us is just one piece of a vast network leading to terraced fields, reservoirs, defensive fortifications, and more, all sprawling invisibly throughout the forest. In the 1,000-plus years since the Maya society collapsed, the jungle has returned with a vengeance. A tide of flora has swallowed up roads and temples, turning stone structures into lumps and mounds indistinguishable from the natural topography. Garrison, an expert at picking out buried structures, has walked right by this road for years, never knowing it was there. But now a revolutionary technology called LIDAR is giving archaeologists a god's-eye view of the rainforest and what's buried underneath. LIDAR, which stands for Light Detection and Ranging, bathes the jungle canopy in a stream of laser beams delivered from planes flying above. As the light bounces back, it creates a precise map of surface contours beneath the forest canopy. Back in camp, Garrison pulls up the data from his laptop. Maya ruins leap from the featureless jungle, giving new meaning to the landscape that surrounds us. The researcher's base shows up as a small bundle of small huddle of buildings. Surrounding it, hundreds of Maya structures stipple the ground in every direction. Some Garrison knew about, the majority, however, are brand new to him at least. Back in 2016, Garrison and a group of archaeologists organized a sweeping LIDAR survey of the heart of Maya civilization, once centered here in the Guatemalan lowlands. Their scans covered 800 square miles across the Piton region, which covers much of Guatemala's northern half. It's just a fraction of the former Maya territory, yet LIDAR revealed some 60,000 previously unknown structures. Now researchers can comprehend the full scale of this ancient civilization, from vastly expanded trade and agriculture to surprising military sophistication. After decades of digging, new and exciting dimensions of Maya society are finally coming to light. Over 1,000 years ago, the Maya dominated this environment. They emerged around 1000 BC and, over the next millennia, rose to become the preeminent Mesoamerican civilization. Millions of people lived in the forest, members of a loose alliance of interconnected city-states. The Maya developed a system of writing as well as a calendar system and sophisticated astronomical charts. In a world without metal, they built towering temples in cities like Tikal and Chichen Itza, as well as roads and reservoirs and irrigation networks and terraced fields. Their civilization spanned thousands of square miles of jungle across Central America. In the past, archaeologists have relied on small, scattered dig sites to describe the scope of the civilization. That's given us a limited view of the Maya. We've unlocked the secrets of the Maya language, peeled back the jungle at sites like Tikal, and stuffed museums full of ancient artifacts. These efforts have revealed many details of Maya life, but not the full scope of it. Several mysteries remain. How complex was their society? How did city-states grow and fall and grow again? And how did a civilization untouched by the Iron Age rise from the forbidden jungle only to fall apart? If we just do excavations of small areas, you'd get just this little peephole view of the Maya people, says Timothy Hare, a professor of anthropology at Morehead State University, who's involved in a similar mapping project. LIDAR is putting the ancient society into a much broader context. Mounds and hills now stand out as temples and fortresses tied to suburbs and farmlands. It gives you a sense of connections across a big area as opposed to just little points of information from this mound or that pyramid or that temple, says Stephen Houston, a Maya archaeologist at Brown University who works with Garrison's team. Suddenly, everything becomes connected. Everything is seen as being part of a single functional space. The iconic Temple 4 at Tikal, once featured in Star Wars, draws tourists from around the world. Tikal's famed summit is barely visible across the canopy jungle from the Temple of the Night Sun, a hidden pyramid in the nearby ruined city of El Zatz. Unlike Tikal's tourist mecca, the Temple of the Night Sun is still slowly fading into the jungle. As I travel with Garrison, it's our destination, if we can make it through the dense foliage. 1,500 years ago, the jungle would have been much more hospitable. Tikal, where temples have been methodically cleared of overgrowth, offers a hint of what Guatemala might have looked like back then. Broad pathways linked temple complexes. Stone buildings bounded spacious courtyards. Outside of city centers, clusters of fields and reservoirs broke up the jungle. Villages were nestled into nearby clearings. Today, some 14 miles of thick jungle separate El Zatz from Tikal's metropolis. But in the time of the Maya, the two were almost too close for comfort. Garrison's excavations here reveal an alternating history of aggression and allegiance with Tikal, as the dynasty of El Zatz waxed and waned in concert with their larger neighbor. In one side of the Temple of the Night Sun's pyramid, archaeologists have carved a tunnel. It twists and turns through layers and representing hundreds of years of Maya construction. Inside, fearsome stucco masks adorn what was once a temple atop the structure. They represent a central figure of the Maya pantheon, the sun god, who transformed into a jaguar at nightfall. Deeper inside lies a find unearthed during the 2010 season, a royal tomb containing the remains of the El Zatz dynasty's founder, alongside exquisite ceramics and the bones of sacrificial children. At some point, however, the Maya abandoned the temple complex, uprooted the heart of the kingdom, and moved to a new location about half a mile downhill. Garrison thinks the sudden move was likely related to a time of great upheaval in this part of the Maya world. In AD 378, Tikal fell to a distant power, the city today known as Teotihuacan, far to the northwest in Mexico. Tikal's king was killed and replaced by an outsider, and the kingdom became something like a vassal state to the foreign state. Garrison and Houston disagree as to the exact effects of this violent uprising. Houston argues that it was a time of devastation and tragedy for the Maya. Their dynasty was toppled, and their culture was subsumed by another. To live in Tikal at this time would have been to exist under the heel of a foreign power, he says. Garrison sees a different narrative. Though the change of rulers was certainly brutal, he argues that the result was ultimately beneficial. As evidence, he points to the fact that the city rapidly expanded its territory in the aftermath, and likely allied itself with El Zatz. The result was a new era of prosperity for El Zatz, still evident today. Walking through the grassy city center, we pass multiple temples, mortuary complexes, and a ball court. Public markets were likely held nearby, and the city is surrounded by outlying groups of Maya homes, where thatched huts once stood. What were likely cacao fields lie further up in the hills. This area has been thoroughly examined and plotted, the result of 7 years of meticulous work. Had LIDAR been around then, that work would likely have been much quicker. The technology has transformed the day-to-day work of archaeology in the jungle. Uncovering ruins once required informed guesswork. Now the team can pinpoint spots of interest. Some days you'd go and you'd be trudging all day and you get to this hilltop where you're excited to find something, and then you get there and it's just nothing, Garrison says. That never happens with LIDAR. When you go out to do your recon or your ground truthing, you know exactly where you're going to end up that day. Garrison has a surplus World War II gas mask bag hung over his shoulder, the same satchel Indiana Jones carried. He's got the jacket, too, and once had a whip to complete the look, though it has since been lost. An ex-girlfriend took it to Burning Man, he says. Garrison exudes an understated confidence after nearly 20 years of fieldwork, but he'd been getting restless at El Zatz, which had been shaping up to be fairly unspectacular by Maya terms. Other than the royal tomb, they'd uncovered few major finds. That is, until 2016, and LIDAR. Now, it's like a whole new place, he says. The new data is enough to append some previous theories. A 2,700-year-old site called El Pamar sits not far from El Zatz and was once thought of as a small town. Now it appears to have been a major metropolitan area. Roads radiate out from its center, connecting the city's heart to outlying villages, nearly all of which were hidden before the LIDAR scans. We thought it was this podunk little site on the edge of this lagoon, and now it's enormous. It's 40 times larger than we thought it was, Garrison says. This is now this huge city that would have been a rival to Tikal. The scans also hint that the Maya territory wasn't homogeneous. In the eastern Petén Basin, there's a strange concentration of agricultural fields. It may have been a kind of breadbasket for the rest of the region, Garrison thinks. And near El Zatz, the cacao fields could indicate a form of specialization, where farmers traded beans for other staples. Large community markets were likely common in Maya society. In addition to turning towns into cities, the LIDAR data occasionally reveals something even more exciting, not just new structures, but new dimensions of Maya society. On a hillside near the old temple complex at El Zatz, LIDAR revealed a dotted line that ended up being rudimentary fortifications, built to slow incoming attackers. Just this year, Garrison's team uncovered a mound of sling stones at the site, potential ammo cached over 1,000 years ago by some prudent defender. The hillside reveals that the threat of warfare was more pervasive in Maya society, even far before its collapse, than archaeologists believed. And bolstering that theory is an even more surprising discovery. Nearby in the hills above El Zatz, Garrison has found the ruins of something unprecedented in Maya archaeology. Named La Cuernavilla by Garrison, the site is mostly unstudied, but LIDAR scans reveal a clear function. The place was a fortress. Set atop an imposing ridgeline, the fort's impressive scale indicates that whoever occupied it either felt a real threat of attack or wanted to make a show of overwhelming force. La Cuernavilla includes a temple, palace, and the remains of housing platforms, as well as a moat and a massive wall some 25 feet high. One side is protected by a sheer cliff, and the other is strategically fortified with defensive terraces. A watchtower sits nearby, another first for Maya archaeologists, part of a newly discovered defensive network that spreads throughout the entire Maya lowlands. It's the first time archaeologists have found Maya structures built expressly for warfare, and it implies an unexpected level of military engineering. Garrison estimates he came within about 100 feet of it on a previous dig. It's amazing. It's so new. This is the kind of thing that no one ever expected to show up, says Michael Coe, a Yale University archaeologist and Maya scholar who is not involved with the team. It's a major discovery. Excavations so far suggest that the site was occupied for centuries. Garrison's team also unearthed a building that resembles those at Teotihuacan. It's a strong hint that after the Mexican city-state's invasion of Tikal, they began expanding their influence on the surrounding countryside in earnest. The fortress was likely overtaken by Tikal's new rulers and could have served as a military stronghold for occupying forces. When combined with the network of watchtowers, the fortifications look even more strategic. The defensive network seems to spread for miles around El Zatz. And if Garrison is right about this fortress's association with Tikal, it means that the city-state was building military outposts throughout the region to consolidate control on behalf of faraway Teotihuacan. This includes the fortifications that Garrison discovered at El Zatz, which may be part of a larger network. The series of paved limestone platforms interspersed with rocky, torturous terrain would let defending troops rain sling stones and projectiles down on incoming warriors. To me, it's obvious that these are not just balkanized little hilltop fortifications, but this represents some kind of system, says Houston, a former site director at El Zatz. Someone invested a lot of money in these, a lot of sweat, a lot of effort. Though some researchers have long argued that Maya civilization was bigger than assumed, this was the first evidence of strategic defensive fortifications, or what Houston calls an aggressive landscape of surveillance. The organized military activity hints at a new conception of Maya society. The level of resources and planning needed to build La Cuernavilla implies a society with powerful militaristic organization, something that researchers have never before suspected. The evidence of sophisticated military might could be the final piece of evidence that solidifies a theory long gestating in Maya archaeology, that they were much more hierarchically organized than previously thought. The presence of sophisticated agriculture and widespread engineering projects had hinted at a high level of societal control, but University of Nevada, Las Vegas archaeologist Arlen Chase argues a focus on interpreting Maya hieroglyphics kept getting in the way. They're far more centralized than people have given them credit for, Chase says, because the hieroglyphs don't talk about economics. It was just assumed that there was no centralized control of economics, no centralized control of anything. Now, thanks to LIDAR, new sites like La Cuernavilla are indicating the opposite. This is the activity of a well-oiled state machine, Garrison says. His team is now excavating the fortress grounds themselves, collecting pottery fragments to find out when the site was occupied. The scans are great for finding things, but can't establish a timeline. For this task, old-fashioned digging really is the only option, and Garrison sees years of work ahead. He and Houston recently secured two grants from the National Science Foundation and the National Endowment for the Humanities to fund more excavations at the site. This new picture could also help unravel why Maya society quickly, and for the most part mysteriously, vanished around AD 900. Though there's evidence of increased warfare toward the end, what likely precipitated the fall was a drought. A study by scientists from Cambridge University and the University of Florida, Gainesville, published in Science last August, shows that rainfall dropped by roughly half at the time of the civilization's collapse. For a society dependent on irrigation to water the crops, it could well have been a death knell. For centuries, ingenious Maya engineers had altered the landscape in their favor, creating canals to water fields, reservoirs to hold rain through the dry season, turning wetlands to fertile soil, and carving terraces into hillsides. But even with these human enhancements, the Maya remained at the mercy of nature's beneficence. Eventually, it ran out. As the drought dragged on, warfare, already somewhat common between antagonistic city-states, seems to have become more prevalent. The discovery of La Cuerna Villa is poised to help researchers probe the angle further by illuminating the intricacies of Maya militarism. Though the site seems to have been the most active centuries before the collapse, better understanding how the Maya engaged in conflict and to what extent it was integrated into their society will help researchers understand the sequence of events that led to the demise of their society. We do know, though, that little food and too much fighting likely led people to abandon cities. Many probably perished. The Maya population dropped around 90% during this time. Though a few cities would struggle on, the Maya never returned to their former glory. Those who survived fell back into the jungle or squatted in cities. Leaving the research camp, we drive into the gloom of an approaching thunderstorm. Dark mounds loom around us as the battered truck pushes past concrete huts. Occasional lightning bolts paint the distant hills in silhouette, and I wonder what lies beneath them. Garrison's data make clear that the Maya didn't just build cities and towns here in the Petén. They inhabited nearly every square mile of the area. Each hill, every bump in the ground, may conceal the remains of the civilization, and with the echoes of laser beams raining down through the jungle, we'll find them soon enough. Garrison is confident that he's beginning to get a handle on this landscape that he's trekked for years, but never truly seen. It's right there on his laptop screen. Now, all he needs to do is go out and dig. And now, in the Vital Signs feature, Delusions of Grandeur, an economics grad student suddenly believes he's become a disease-fighting doctor. When Alvin arrived at the hospital, he believed he had been sent there as a doctor working on behalf of the U.S. government. "Which patient do I need to see first?" he asked the triage nurse. Until recently, Alvin had been an ordinary economics graduate student, but somehow he had become convinced that he was a trailblazing physician who needed to identify a rare strain of tuberculosis before it spread throughout campus. That morning, he arrived at his graduate school classroom with a stethoscope around his neck, a surgical mask over his face, and a bag containing more masks and several thermometers. He began to practice medicine on his classmates. At first, his manner and physician attire made them think he was joking, as Halloween was just around the corner. But when he tried to remove the shirt of a female student to better listen to her lungs, their late-arriving professor called the police, and the police called an ambulance. What caused this previously healthy 25-year-old man to become delusional? After initial screening from the emergency medicine physician on duty, I was called to sort this out. At the time, I was a new psychiatry resident, but even at that early part of my career, I knew to focus on four possibilities for Alvin's behavior: a stress reaction from a trauma, a manic phase, a psychotic episode, or a drug-induced state. I'd also heard about medical conditions such as lupus and hyperthyroidism that could cause severe psychological changes. But the emergency room doctor found no supporting evidence for those possibilities after his examination. Skimming Alvin's medical records, I learned that he had visited the student health clinic the year before. He was diagnosed with depression but declined treatment. The note also mentioned occasional marijuana use, but not in more than a year. He told the doctors he hadn't used any other street drugs. In terms of his physical health, the record showed he had recently visited the health clinic for cold symptoms and received a prescription decongestant. Essentially, I was starting from scratch. I met Alvin in a small room in the emergency department's psychiatric wing. He paced in a circle and was doing some sort of counting exercise with his fingers. He seemed a few days overdue for a shave and a shower. "Are you okay, doctor?" he asked. "Observe me closely. You looked stressed." I smiled and gently told Alvin that his classmates and teachers had concerns about his mental state, as did the doctors and nurses at the hospital. He nodded. I asked him why he thought they were worried. "Because I've been energetic," he answered. "Maybe too much so for them." "How long have you been feeling this way?" I asked. "A few days, maybe a week. Conventional time isn't as important for me now." He told me he hadn't slept more than 2 or 3 hours a night. And even that felt like too much because he had so much life-saving work to do. He said he hadn't had any recent traumatic experience in his life or with anyone close to him. It sounded like textbook mania, but from what? Alvin's lab results came back. Stepping away to a nearby computer station, I saw that his alcohol level was zero. Also, his urine drug screen, which tested for marijuana, cocaine, PCP, opioids, benzodiazepines, and amphetamines, came back clean. It appeared that drugs were not causing his state. His blood test showed normal liver, kidney, glucose, and electrolyte and mineral values. We still needed to wait for results in his thyroid levels, but I suspected the data would not show an identifiable cause for his behavior. He seemed headed toward a diagnosis of bipolar disorder and treatment through medications. I went back to Alvin's room to perform a physical exam. Before beginning, I asked him how his physical health had been in recent months. He told me he had a bad cold 5 or 6 weeks ago and missed a few days of classes. He saw a doctor who wrote him a prescription, but the medicine didn't help his condition. Alvin said he began to improve only after taking an over-the-counter medicine. Out of curiosity, I asked him its name. "DXM," he said. I stared blankly. Dexamethorphan, he continued. "It's the active ingredient in most cough suppressants. I started with the pills. I switched over to the liquid a few weeks ago." "Switched over a few weeks ago?" The instructions on cold medicines always say to stop use after a week, or at most 10 days. "How long did you end up taking it?" I said. "I'm still using it," he said, reading the confusion on my face. "For recreational purposes." I frowned in surprise. I'd always been naive and cautious about drugs in my personal life, and while I'd seen TV reports on the decongestant pseudoephedrine being used to produce crystal methamphetamine, I hadn't heard anything similar about dextromethorphan to make me view it as a drug that could be abused. Nor had I heard about this in medical school. My offhanded question about the medicine's name opened a new path of investigation. Could this drug explain his behavior? After looking into DXM's history, I found that it was approved by the FDA in 1958 as a non-prescription cough suppressant. During the 1990s, a handful of obscure medical case reports described the potential dangers of DXM when taken in high doses. It could produce psychological symptoms of intense euphoria and alter perceptions of surroundings, similar to what people experience with the drugs ketamine and PCP. As with those drugs, using DXM causes a pleasurable high at first, but it can subsequently lead the user into a psychotic state. For example, in 1996, a medical journal reported the case of a lawyer standing half-naked outside his home and wielding a gun in an effort to free his wife. He believed that she was being held hostage inside. He had been using increasing amounts of cough syrup with DXM for 3 months. In 2005, a few years after my encounter with Alvin, the FDA published a warning on the dangers of taking DXM in high doses. Today, the drug is still part of over 100 cough and cold medicines. In recommended amounts, it's safe, but the potential for abuse is always there. Calvin acknowledged that DXM had clouded his thinking, and he agreed to be admitted to the inpatient psychiatric hospital floor for observation. Once he stopped taking the drug, he returned to his normal state within 3 days. He said during his discharge that what had started out as fun had gotten out of hand and that he had learned his lesson. Alvin's case was an eye-opener for me early in my career. Realizing that both I and the emergency room doctors had almost overlooked this less well-known type of drug abuse, I learned two important lessons. Ask patients extra questions and be humble enough to let them lead you to their diagnosis. And now here's a selection from 20 Things You Didn't Know About Chocolate. Number 1. Chocolate is everywhere, but science is still sorting out this adored product of the domesticated Theobroma cacao tree's beans. Number 2. For centuries, based on linguistic and archaeological evidence, researchers thought chocolate originated in Mexico or Central America about 4,000 years ago. Number three. In October, however, a Nature Ecology and Evolution study of organic residues on artifacts concluded that the Mayo Chinchipe culture was making the stuff nearly 5,500 years ago in what is now Ecuador. Number four, analysis of ancient and modern Theobroma cacao DNA confirmed that the shrubby tree was first domesticated in that upper Amazon basin region. Number five, as it spread north, chocolate became a luxury commodity worthy of tribute to the gods for the Aztec, Maya, and other Mesoamerican civilizations. Six, but Mesoamerican chocolate has little in common with the modern treat. It was a paste of ground cocoa beans mixed with combinations of water, corn, fruit, chili peppers, or honey, creating a porridge or beverage. 7. When chocolate first arrived in Europe in the 16th century, it was a warm drink made with chocolate liquor. The term refers to ground cocoa paste, about half of which is cocoa solids. The rest is cocoa butter. Number 8. Chocolate liquor is better known today as baking chocolate. Eating chocolate came into being in the mid-19th century, when European confectioners added sugar and extra cocoa butter to chocolate liquor, creating what's known today as dark chocolate. Number 9. In the 1870s, a Swiss chocolatier added milk powder, inventing, yes, milk chocolate. White chocolate, a 20th century invention, doesn't contain cocoa solids, so it's not technically chocolate. Number 10. Mega company Barry Callebaut introduced ruby chocolate with much marketing fanfare in late 2017, but won't share the science behind the rosy-hued concoction. Independent experts have speculated it's made from unfermented cocoa beans that have been acidified, a process the firm patented in 2009. 11. If true, the lack of fermentation could explain why foodies who have tried it say it has no real chocolate taste. Chocolate relies on fermentation for a lot of its flavor. Number 12. After harvest, diverse microbes produce acids and other waste products, mostly in the gooey pulp that surrounds the raw cocoa beans. This kicks off biochemical changes in the beans themselves, ultimately affecting taste. Number 13. In September, in Royal Society Open Science, researchers published the first quantitative model for this complex process. Complicating things even more, small-scale cocoa growers, who produce 90% of the world's beans, vary widely in fermentation techniques. And number 14, these mom-and-pop operations are struggling. Less than 1% of chocolate could be considered fair trade. Inequality between large companies and growers is actually increasing, as is chocolate production-associated deforestation. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jory Slodke, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. Again, that's area code 919-832-5138.